Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck. It's the 1 o'clock hour. I just had a nice Caesar salad. So that means it's time for Stuff You Should Know.
How do you dress yours lightly, or do you like it soggy?
I do it smartly.
No.
I start out light and then add as needed.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've experienced the regret of too much salad dressing.
Right. You can't take it away.
No. You can't unring that bell.
You cannot. Yeah. Rolling Stone magazine. What's your history with this rag?
It's it goes back a couple of days at least.
Oh, you were never into the magazine at all?
No. I mean, I've read plenty of like Rolling Stone articles over the years, like Matt Taibbi's stuff, some Hunter Thompson stuff. And
of course,
you know, every once in a while I'll just run across a really good article from like years back, right? But that was it. Never had a subscription, never bought it at the magazine rack or anything like that.
Okay.
You know, I just wasn't into it. I didn't hate on it or anything like that. I just was never into it.
Not like you're going to today?
I won't hate on it today. I'll just reveal facts.
Yeah. So my history, if you care, is I always loved Rolling Stone magazine, and I continue to digitally subscribe. And you know, it is, as we will learn, it is not a magazine without its downs and controversies.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, it's, as Ed even points out in this research, like, it's sort of been sport over the last two decades to sort of debate when and if Rolling Stone has lost its way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a magazine that I always, I just took what I took from it.
Right.
Like when I was reading, you know, at the end of this, we'll get to some of their biggest controversial articles and like very poor, shoddy journalism. And like, I never read any of those. So I've always just sort of taken from it what I wanted to and not really thought about it a lot until this research.
Man, there's nothing more rock and roll than that.
But I do want to plug another magazine.
What?
Cream Magazine is back.
Oh, really? Yeah, I've seen people be, you know, the ones in the know are like, Cream was always better than Rolling Stone.
Well, it was. And, like, my magazine of choice for music since the probably early 2000s was Magnet, which I still...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it went away, then it came back. And then, but Cream is back now, and I subscribed immediately. You get four paper copies per year, like a quarterly issue, which is kind of cool.
Sure.
But what's really cool, dude, is if you subscribe, you get access to all of the archives. So it's really fun to go back and read like a contemporaneous Lester Bangs or Cameron Crowe piece. From Cream Magazine. So I highly recommend here at the beginning of our Rolling Stone article to subscribe to the new Cream.
Right. So yeah, Cream, the impression I have is Cream is the one that like really was true to what it was going for pretty much from start to finish. While Rolling Stone was viewed as more of like the corporate version of that almost from the outset.
Yeah.
The reason that it was viewed as that and still is today is because the guy, one of the founders, Jan Wenner, was super corporate. Like, that was his goal. He was an ambitious hippie hanger-on, basically, who happened to be in San Francisco when the Summer of Love happened, when psychedelic rock broke out, when, like, the 60s, like, really were like, happening, and San Francisco was the epicenter. And that's not to say he, like, didn't dig it and wasn't right. moved by it, but sure. he also saw that this was a really important thing, at least to him and a lot of other people, and he saw that he could probably sell ads against this. So he did what he knew how to do, and he started a magazine, as we'll see.
Yeah, that's a nice little intro. And thanks. For those of you who don't know, Rolling Stone is a music, largely music magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But also in, over the ensuing years, is since November 9th, 1967, has branched out into all manner of pop culture and politics. And, you know, we didn't want to not mention what it was in case you happened to live under a Rolling Stone.
Oh, man. Is that written down in your notes?
No, I was off the dome.
Yeah. Whoa.
So should we go back in time a bit?
Yeah, let's get in the Wayback Machine and go back to the 60s in San Francisco. And
it's dusty maybe, in here.
Get a contact buzz from some grass that's being smudged.
They called it grass back then. Yeah. Ed is very astute to point out that the origins of Rolling Stone is kind of born out of this sort of certainly 1960s, but maybe even before, left-wing alt rags that are self-published, these sort of poorly printed black and white magazines mm-hmm. about the counterculture that never really desired to make money. And, you know, most of them were super regional and never, like, went outside of usually the city that they were in as far as distribution. But Rolling Stone was kind of born out of this idea, and in particular got a lot of its influence from a San Francisco-based magazine called Ramparts.
Yeah, which was a, like, far, far left, radical left politics magazine. There was a headline in, I think, 1968, maybe even earlier than that, that Ramparts ran. It was, Ramparts offers $10,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any cop who has murdered a black man. That was on their cover. But it was on their cover, and there's yeah. like a cop pointing a gun at you, the viewer, from the magazine's cover. And that's, you know, okay, that's, you know, shocking, especially for even back then. But it's even more shocking when you realize that just a few years before, Ramparts had been launched as an intellectual Catholic quarterly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know why they kept the same name. It was a complete redo.
It really was. And the guy who redid it was a guy named Warren Hinkle. And you can't talk about Rolling Stone without talking about Warren Hinkle.
That's right. He transformed that magazine into that, you know, that leftist rag that they knew. And it was, you know, obviously big in San Francisco, but it reached national levels of fame, if not like widespread fame. Like the writers were like featured on talk shows and other kind of notably, I guess, when you're a magazine being written by other magazine being written about by other magazines, mm-hmm. you've definitely made your mark. And Time Magazine even had a very famous article called A Bomb in Every Issue. I think it was a cover article on Ramparts Magazine.
Right.
And though it would exist alongside Rolling Stone for a little while in the 70s, it was not a big, widespread financial success. And obviously because of his politics had a pretty, just by nature of what it was, a sort of limited audience.
Right. And so Jan Wenner, who was one of the founders of Rolling Stone, who basically personified Rolling Stone over the decades, because he was the CEO for years and years and years, mm-hmm. he was involved in Ramparts through a guy named Ralph Gleason, who we'll meet in a second. But the upshot of this is that Jan Wenner saw Ramparts, what it was doing, how important it was, and that it never really took off. That I saw it blew through at least two personal fortunes, Rampart Magazine did before it declared bankruptcy. And he noted that, and he kind of took it to heart for his magazine, Rolling Stone. And the lesson for him was reflect the counterculture without actually like furthering the agenda, and you can probably be absorbed by much more people and be palatable to advertisers too.
Yeah, and as far as Winter goes, he himself was a college dropout from Berkeley. He is sort of the personification of what we now think of as like the boomer generation, which is to say that he, and probably still does, you know, just sort of laud that generation and everything they did as of the utmost importance. And the music of the time and the movements of the time were truly historic and not to be trifled with. And also in a sort of boomer-esque way, said, but you know what's great is making tons of money.
Right.
And being a capitalist.
And loving Coke.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure that was not, I'm sure they were not in short supply.
No, they weren't. He was, very famous for his ability to put away bags of cocaine.
All right, so you mentioned Ralph Gleason, who we're going to meet. He was a jazz critic, a music critic, who also dabbled in the rock and roll world, but he was not a boomer. He was born in, I think, 1917. So he was 30-ish years older than Venner, and they met at a Jefferson Airplane concert and became buddies. And I think Jan Winter really looked up to him, and they sort of developed a mentor relationship, mentee. Is that what it is?
It depends. So if Gleason was strictly kind of advising and training and teaching Jan Winter, that would make him a mentee. But if he did anything to further Jan Winter's career, which he ended up doing, that would make Winter his protege.
Okay. Well, let's just say it was a mix of both.
Sure. I just I looked it up, and I really wanted to share that.
I gotcha. Okay. There is a distinction.
Sure.
But they were friends, and I believe it was Gleason that also worked for Ramparts some. And then when Ramparts fell apart, they hatched the idea for Rolling Stone magazine.
Well, so Gleason left even before Ramparts fell apart, because Warren Hinkle did not love the psychedelic rock era, did not love hippies, and Ralph Gleason did. Even though he was a jazz critic, he definitely got the psychedelic movement and was very appreciative of it, and wrote very kindly about it in his columns in Ramparts. But their falling out happened when Warren Hinkle ran The Social History of the Hippies, which was a pretty unflattering cover story about hippies and the Summer of Love, and how basically he accused them of falling down on the job of taking over the responsibility to steer the country. And instead they were just off like dropping acid and shirking their responsibility, which would pan out to be really prescient when you're talking about the baby boomer generation, right? And Ralph Gleason didn't appreciate that at all. So he left in disgust. He quit Ramparts. And that was about the time when Winter was like, hey, let's make a magazine together.
Summer of Love, 1970. Who can forget?
I know. Oh, wait, no, it was 72.
72.
Yeah, because John Travolta played at the Woodstock for that Summer of Love concert in 72.
Oh, boy. I always feel bad for people who don't pick up on the inside jokes.
Yeah.
We'll get some emails. That's all right. It's fun. Yeah. So they, again, hatched this idea together, and they really kind of borrowed a lot from Ramparts, not the least of which was their logo. if you look at the Ramparts logo, it's I don't know if it's exactly the same font. I'm sure they probably technically might have made a new font, but it looks a lot like that font, and not the original Rolling Stone magazine font, because the earliest issues, it was definitely a little bit different. But the one that we all know today is the Rolling Stone font, looks a lot like Ramparts. They definitely hired away a lot of people from that magazine, including you know, some of the designers, some of the writers, some of the editors, photographers, and even the office space. They raised, they wanted to raise 10 grand, but they ended up raising $7,500 from a variety of investors, including, Jane Winter, and her family, who was, Jan Winter's wife, who actually had a much larger role in the early days of the magazine than I believe she's usually given credit for.
Yeah, I saw it described in, I think it was an Atlantic article. Is that where it was?
Yeah, that was a great article.
It really was. I think it was called The Rise and Fall of Rolling Stone or something like that. And Jane Schindelheim Wenner is described as basically being the she was so cool that her personality was what attracted those, you know, cool photographers and cool musicians and just people to the magazine, that they wanted to be close to her, basically, or she knew how to behave around them, basically.
Yeah, and they had a interesting marriage. He came out of the closet in the mid-90s, much to her surprise. Apparently, she had heard rumors over the years and things like that, but I think it was sort of a sudden thing for her and did not go down well. And I believe he's been in a partnership with the same gentleman since then.
Yeah, it was a sudden surprise for Jan Wenner too, because I read that he was outed by the Wall Street Journal without his permission or even even a heads up.
Really?
They just outed him in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. The author even pondered, like, wow, is this scandal going to be the thing that sinks Rolling Stone? But it was 1995 by then, or 94, and everybody's like, sure. Who cares? You know, I don't think that qualifies as a scandal.
Yeah, absolutely. So they have this money. They got the $7,500. Ed points out that Jan Wenner kept his Porsche, though. It's not like he sold his Porsche to raise money for the magazine. Mm-hmm. So they got the money together and they hire a bunch of the Ramparts people. They, in fact, used a lot of the same equipment. The magazine was the same size, had a bit of the same look. Mm-hmm. They had a bunch of unused paper from Ramparts that they were able to use. And they even used the offices where they printed it. I think the loft above the office was where they first made their home. So
yeah,
they really had a bit of a head start.
Yeah, and so Ramparts had spun off something called the Sunday Ramparts newspaper, and that's what had gone defunct. So Ramparts, the magazine, is still going at this time, but they used all the Sunday Ramparts newspaper stuff, including staff, right? So they have...
Well, Wenner worked for them.
Yeah, and when Gleason quit in protest, and I think shortly after that, the Sunday Ramparts newspaper folded. That's when they got together and did this. And they, like you said, they did it with $7,500, and they were able to print, I think, 40,000 copies of Rolling Stone number one. Mm-hmm. There was a last-minute decision to put a production still of John Lennon from the movie How I Won the War. He's wearing like fatigues and like a helmet with netting on it and everything. And he's looking at the camera. It's a very famous photograph. And they said that it was like a perfect mix or perfect metaphor for the mix of like politics, culture, and music all rolled into one. It really was a perfect photo for Rolling Stone number one's cover, for sure.
I think so. And maybe we could take a break and talk about how that first issue fared. How's that for a cliffhanger?
It's great.
All right, we'll be right back.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.
Hey friends, if you've ever been in the market for a new home, you know home shopping can be a lot. There's so much you don't know and so much you need to know. Like, what are the neighborhoods like? What are the schools like? Who is the agent who knows the listing or neighborhood the best? And why can't all this information just be in one place?
Yeah, well, now it is, everybody, on Homes.com. They've got everything you need to know about the listing itself, but even better. They've got comprehensive neighborhood guides and detailed reports about local schools, and their agent directory helps you see the agent's current listings and sales history. Homes.com collaboration tools make it easier than ever to share all this information with your family.
It's a whole cul-de-sac of home shopping information all at your fingertips. Homes.com, we've done your homework.
Hey, everybody, if you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. You start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com. Did it sell?
No.
Did it sell?
No, Chuck.
Now, that first 40,000, I believe 34,000 issues were returned. I think a lot of this was in part to the fact that they tried to be their own distributor, which they realized right away was not a good idea. And so they quickly signed deals with distributors and newsstands and realized that, you know, at 25 cents a copy, weren't going to make a lot of money with that sort of distributor partnership model.
No. So, I mean, they did the sensible thing. They gave up a pretty significant chunk of their margin to that distribution company. But in return, they were able to grow, like from issue number two or three. I'm not sure exactly when they took on that new distributor, but it was pretty soon after the failure of the first issue.
Yeah, and then they started selling pretty well. As far as the name goes, they did get, I think, sort of threatened, legally speaking, by the Rolling Stones music group. But they sort of got out of that pretty quickly. I think they may have realized, hey, maybe it's good to be friends with this up-and-coming music magazine. I don't really know for sure, but
well, yeah,
that would make sense.
Yeah, I saw it described as a letter writing campaign or a correspondence between that was initiated by Mick Jagger to Jan Wenner, basically saying, hey man, you can use this, but how about some free advertising and lots of really good coverage and all that?
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought might have happened.
Yeah. And I guess it got dropped or something like that. Supposedly only that initial letter survived, so no one knows exactly how it panned out. But Jan Wenner was definitely the kind of person to trade, you know, space for something else, like maybe advertising dollars or, you know,
cocaine.
A favorable review of a record in return for that record company or the parent company advertising in Rolling Stone. He was definitely not only not above doing that, he was actively chasing that kind of opportunity.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think there's a lot of people that would stand up and say that Jan Wenner was the greatest boss they ever had, especially back in those days. I think he might have cleaned up his act, you know, later on, but in the 60s and 70s, it was very well known that he would, like you said, make these sort of under-the-table deals. He would play labels and writers against one another. ad salespeople against one another. He was apparently a pretty cruel editor. He was never the best writer in the world. He wrote some reviews and things here and there, but that wasn't his strong suit. But yeah, he was known as being fairly misogynist and sexist and sort of all the things you might imagine from a sort of magazine editor-in-chief in the 1970s.
Yeah, like a good example, for the first issue and early on in Rolling Stone's life, a guy named Michael Lydon was the managing editor, and he used to write for Newsweek. And he brought his wife Linda along, who was also a writer and an editor, and Jan Winter made Linda answer the phones because she was one of the few women working there.
Right. It's a good example.
Yeah.
And this isn't a hit piece. There's a very well-known biography of Jan Winter out there that is also, while not a hit piece, not very kind to him at all.
The Sticky Fingers one that came out?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he had been, apparently Jan Winter had been shopping his story around for, you know, to be written initially by a ghostwriter and then finally a biographer. And like, he couldn't get anybody to do it because he was just known as such a control freak. And everybody was like, I do not want to be involved with you for 3 or 4 years writing your story. Like, he would pick apart line by line captions under photos in magazines. Yeah. This is in the 90s. He was still doing this, you know? Like, he was that kind of boss. So you can just imagine what a train wreck nightmare he would have been if you were his biographer. He finally got somebody to do it, but that somebody said, dude, you've got to give me creative control over this. You have to give me freedom. And, the guy, like you said, it wasn't a hit piece, but it also wasn't just fawning and flattering. Like, apparently Jan Winter had kind of hoped it would be.
Right, of course. As far as circulation goes, they say that it peaked in 2008 with a circulation of 1.4 million and is around 500,000 today, about 27,000 of which is actually, I believe, like, you know, paper copies. Although maybe that's just newsstand and not subscription.
Yeah, I was wondering if that number reflects their digital subscribership, because that's kind of low, actually.
It is. And honestly, I never really knew what magazine distribution equaled anyway. So I was surprised that it peaked at 1.4 million, which just seems, for such an iconic magazine, that just doesn't seem like a lot of human beings reading a magazine.
No, I mean, think about it. We're not too far off from Rolling Stone's peak, you know?
I didn't want to say that, but that's what I was thinking. I was like, wow.
I'll say it. I had a Caesar salad for lunch, so I'm feeling rather chuffed.
Anyway, I don't know what I thought it would be. I figured it'd be like 10 million or something like that.
But no, that's still rather respectable. 1.4 million, that's subscribers
too,
I believe. Yeah, or it's circulation. I think that includes newsstand sales. But the reason I'm wondering whether the web or the digital subscribers are included in that later number, the recent stuff, is because they very famously, or I should say Jan Winter very famously, shunned the idea of moving into the digital realm.
Yeah,
and even as well, his son Gus was the guy who was running the digital arm. He still wouldn't give him resources to support like a genuine website.
Yeah.
An example I saw is that Rolling Stone broke some story. I can't remember what story it was, but it was a big story. And everybody had to go read about it on other digital news sites because they hadn't posted anything or the story on Rolling Stone's website. Like, it was like that.
Interesting. They've also changed format just size-wise over the years. They started out, as a sort of regular-sized, smaller magazine, or should I just say average magazine. And it was in black and white with a little bit of color here and there, like a single-color process. And then in the early 70s, switched to a four-color process and went to that glossy, large format style that Rolling Stone, like, to me, was really known for. It was always just different because it was a big, large magazine.
But also, it was glossy, but it wasn't like the glossy, slick magazine pages of today. Wasn't it glossy newsprint, basically?
Yeah.
So that ended up, that gave it its own feel, too, along with the size. Like, it was definitely its own thing.
Right. But then it went back to the small, and then now is back to the big. Isn't that right?
Yeah, in 2008, they went to standard magazine size. In 2018, they said, forget it. We're going back to the 10 by 12.
I'm glad they did. I mean, I don't buy the paper version, but I just always associated that sort of iconic 10 by, turns out, 11 and 3/4 size. It's a quarter inch, really bugs me.
Yeah, it does. You just made me snort, man.
Well, good.
So initially Rolling Stone was like a national magazine that was centered in San Francisco because, again, that was the epicenter of the hippie movement, of everything that was going on that was important in the late 60s and early 70s, right? But then Jan Wenner kind of spiritually decamped from San Francisco even before the magazine did. And then finally, Ralph Gleason, you remember Ralph Gleason, the jazz critic who kind of co-founded Rolling Stone, he'd kept a column in every issue where basically he was just talking about San Francisco goings on or whatever. And he eventually was like the last tether to the origin, the roots in San Francisco. And when he died in 1975, Jan Wenner waited a couple more years and then moved the whole thing to New York City. And it was officially a bona fide national, you can even say international magazine around that time.
Yeah, and I think from what I understand, when Gleason died, he was sort of battling with Wenner at the time. And that they had fallings out. And I believe, I'm not so sure if it was personal, but maybe it got personal, but it was definitely over like the direction of the magazine, I think. I always got the feeling that Gleason was a little less likely to be accused of some of the sort of sellout things that Wenner would eventually be accused of.
He was a jazz critic. That's not exactly a profession you pursue when you're an ambitious, money-hungry, you know, Wall Street type.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
So Ed makes a really good point here. I've seen it elsewhere, too, and it's kind of like something that people have realized in the last, like, few years, maybe the last decade or so, and that is that Rolling Stone is possibly the most important mouthpiece for the boomer generation.
Yeah.
And that it was so important, it's entirely possible that things like Woodstock or the Beatles or the Summer of Love or all the stuff we associate with the beginnings of boomers and then onward and onward, that Rolling Stone amplified it to a way that now we think of those things as like historic events, but they might not be. We might think of them as historic events because Rolling Stone amplified it.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. But I do agree that it has been a boomer mouthpiece for sure.
For sure.
But I don't think that one could reasonably make an argument that the Beatles wouldn't be the Beatles had it not been for Rolling Stone magazine coverage.
No. I don't think that's the point. I think the point is, would we consider the Beatles as having changed the world if Rolling Stone had never been there?
Yeah, I definitely think so.
All right.
That's just my opinion.
Okay. What about Wings?
Oh, I love Wings. Man, Jet, give me that all day long. One thing Rolling Stone was definitely at the forefront of, even though they did not create what's called the new journalism. And this was basically when journalism went from kind of anonymous style reporting to putting the writer right in the middle of the story. And sometimes the story was even about the writer in the case of a Hunter S. Thompson, who was also at the forefront of new journalism. Mm-hmm. And it was very literary style writing. It was very, not flowery because that sounds kind of haughty, but just sort of a higher caliber literary style writing than typical journalism had been. I love it. I've always been a big fan of new journalism. Mm-hmm. I think it has its place and shouldn't be confused with other kinds of journalism, but I've always been a big, big fan.
Yeah, it's amazing. So Hunter Thompson, he was so at the forefront of it. He actually spun off his own sub-discipline called gonzo journalism, which is new journalism to the extreme. Like when you spell extreme starting with an X kind of thing, right?
Why haven't we done an episode entirely on him yet?
I don't know.
Weird?
We will someday.
It just seems very strange for us.
But Jan Wenner did not discover Hunter Thompson. He was actually kind of introduced to the magazine world. He'd already written Hell's Angels in 1968.
Great book.
He'd made a name for himself, but the first piece of gonzo journalism is considered the Kentucky Derby is decadent and depraved.
Uh-huh.
That was commissioned by Warren Hinkle who had gone off and started another magazine.
Right, and, former Rampart's chief.
Yes, exactly. And Warren Hinkle was the genius who put Ralph Steadman and Hunter Thompson together. Mm. And they first appeared together in the, I can't remember, Scanlon's, I think is the name of the magazine, with the Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved. And so Jan Winter saw this. He's like, this guy needs to come write for me. Or I think it might have been the other way around. I think Hunter Thompson showed up at Rolling Stone's offices and basically demanded that he be made a writer for that magazine.
Yeah, and was certainly, you know, one of the most famous writers they ever had, along with Cameron Crowe, of course, was mm-hmm. well known as a teenage writer for Rolling Stone magazine.
I know. He got a cover assignment age 16
yeah,
to follow the Allman cool. Brothers. And that's what Almost Famous is based on.
Yeah, and he very famously, too, it was sort of based on his work with the band Eagles.
You mean the Eagles?
It's Eagles. And I always just like to annoy people by saying Eagles.
That's awesome.
Because it's like, who else was it? Or I might have already talked about this. It's Eagles and, Hall & Oates. It's like Daryl Hall has a big bee in his bonnet about the fact that they're not Hall & Oates. They were always Daryl Hall and John Oates.
Oh, really?
And he's like, people just called us that, and that's not on any of the records. They all say Daryl Hall and John Oates.
Huh.
And the Eagles, Don Henley's always like, it never was the Eagles, it's Eagles.
That's funny.
I'm like, all right, just relax.
Another way to annoy people, Chuck, is just to play Eagles music.
Right. I came back around with the Eagles.
Did you? That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I took off. I loved them growing up, and I took off probably 20 years. Two solid decades of no Eagles.
That's great.
And then I came back around and was like, I love this music. What am I doing?
You're back off the wagon.
So anyway, Hunter S. Thompson, very famous writer for them, obviously. And he did something which other writers in the new journalism school would do, which was, including one Tom Wolfe, was use the magazine as not a testing ground, but as sort of the beginnings of what would become books by writing these sort of chapter-like installments every issue. And Hunter S. Thompson did that. Tom Wolfe did that with his early work on what would become The Right Stuff and The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah, man. Tom Wolfe, I think, is I prefer Tom Wolfe to Hunter Thompson these days. I think he's
interesting.
Yeah, I just like him more. But Hunter Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was born out of two different assignments where Rolling Stone sent him to Las Vegas, first to cover the Mint 400, and then to cover that, then to
the
cover
the convention,
right? The police convention on drugs. And that's where the book came from. Was those his submissions from those two assignments?
I think Tom Wolfe is the natural graduation point from, like, you like Hunter S. Thompson more in your 20s and 30s, maybe.
Yeah, but I also read Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Yeah,
around the same time. And I was just like, I love Hunter Thompson, but Tom Wolfe is just, I think, by far the better journalist.
Yeah, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test is the only thing I've read by Tom Wolfe, actually.
The Right Stuff is really amazing, too.
I know.
The thing about Tom Wolfe is he, because he's a new journalist, he writes about things where he can be kind of involved or like he's there or it's really kind of like he puts you in the middle of what's going on, sometimes in people's like bedrooms at night when a guy's talking to his wife. And he does it so well that you forget, first of all, that you're not there, but then you forget that he wasn't there either.
Right.
Like he's working off interviews, sometimes other authors' notes. he just gives the, he's so good at it. You just assume like he was there for all this stuff and he wasn't there for any of it.
There's like a couple in bed and it just pans over and Tom Wolfe sitting there in his seersucker suit.
Yep, exactly.
With his legs crossed. Very interesting.
That's right. Can you say that again?
Other famous writers early on that went on to have outsized careers elsewhere is MTV's Kurt Loder, Joe Esterhaus, screenwriter and filmmaker.
Of what?
Oh, Esterhaus was Fatal Attraction, right?
Fatal Attraction? It just goes downhill from there. Basic Instinct,
yeah.
Sliver, Showgirls, Jade.
Showgirls, of course.
But it's weird. Like, he had a real type. His screenplay was a real...
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, like, hey, you want to see some boobs, 12-year-old kid? Come see my movies. That was Joe Esterhaus's jam.
Yeah, absolutely. Lester Bangs from Cream Magazine wrote for Rolling Stone. And then, of course, the legendary journalist, Ben Fong Torres, who was one of the greatest Rolling Stone writers in their history, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And all these people, like, were legitimately great writers. And they were contributing to this music magazine that really just also had its finger on the pulse of really good journalism, too.
Yeah, so in that article on the from The Atlantic, they do quite a bit of speculating on sort of when they think Rolling Stone might have started selling out and become something untrue to its roots. And they basically talk about even in the 70s and 80s, basically, you know, Jan Wenner saw the writing on the wall and said, hey, we can't just be a boomer archive and a nostalgia jam. And I want to sell magazines. So we're going to start writing about TV shows and comedians and I mean, they always wrote about politics, but, you know, really expanded beyond the sort of mission statement, which was a largely music magazine, which also wrote about politics. And it became something else entirely and really became a popular, hugely popular magazine.
Yeah, because, I mean, like Rolling Stone as an institution was just keeping up with the times. If it was, you know, looking backward to like the greatest moments in boomer history, you can thank Jan Wenner almost personally for that. And so it's kind of weird as Jan Wenner, who was like controlling everything, he had to let the magazine reinvent itself, even though he personally, you know, I'm sure he did. He went to Studio 54 and stuff like that in the 70s and, like, you know, went to Sardi's for lunch in the 80s and all that stuff. But he, like, I saw an interview with him in 2017, and he just casually tosses out the Stones and the Beatles. And it's like, it's 2017, man. And this guy's still citing, like, the big three whenever he brings up music from the 60s, right?
So, which were who?
It was the Beatles
probably.
It was the Beatles, the Stones. I think I automatically question somebody who uses the Stones, and that's it. And then, man, I'm trying to find this quote. It was like an interview with NPR. The Beatles, the Stones, and Dylan. That's another thing,
too. Of course.
If you just say Dylan and the Stones.
I say both those things.
All right, Chuck. But My point is that Jan Wenner is frequently accused of what's called rockism, which is, we talked about it in our Rock and Roll Hall of Fame episode, this idea that rock is white guys using a bass, an electric guitar, drums, maybe a rhythm guitar, and a lead singer. They probably use a lot of hair product, and like, that's rock, and nothing else matters. Apparently, Jan Wenner really personifies that. And one of the reasons why people get snubbed from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inexplicably is because of him specifically, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, is he the head chair or is he just on the board?
He's definitely high up in it, enough that he can be like, no, I don't even want them on the ballot kind of thing.
Yeah, and if you remember our Rock and Roll Hall of Fame episode, we talk about snubs, and a lot of people have had very personal beefs with Wenner over the years because of this. I'm going to read a couple of choice quotes from his, this from the Atlantic article, but from his biography.
Yeah.
Wenner was a little barbarian whose lust for money, drugs, and sex threatened to outpace his razor intellect and turn him into Augustus Gloop, falling into the chocolate river of the 1960s. Rolling Stone was an expression of Wenner's pursuit of fame and power, a magazine more than occasionally at the mercy of his editor's unembarrassed appetite for stardom and excess, which made him an object of scorn and parody. And basically he said it was a parable for the age of narcissism. And then one final little bit here. As newsstand sales rose, Wenner became hungry for still more sales. By the mid-70s, the focus of Rolling Stone had shifted from what the editors determined to be the best in pop culture to what was measurably the biggest.
Yeah.
And I think that was where a lot of people say he lost his way. It was like, well, what's hot? Let's just write about that, not what's great.
Yeah, I saw there was a dust-up years back, I guess in the 90s maybe, where one of his music reviewers didn't write a flattering review of Hootie and the Blowfish's latest album. And Jan Wenner himself killed the review and had assigned it to another writer who wrote a much more favorable review. And they were like, well, you know, this record company is a huge advertiser with Rolling Stone, and That's what he just did that, you know? And I think people see him as a founder of this like really hip magazine that was like a voice and a reflection of the times, and it kept reinventing itself, and they want him to be like legit and grounded in like that kind of ethos, and he just wasn't. Like, people wanted to pigeonhole him like that, and he just was not like that. I don't know him well enough, and I haven't read his biography, to see if he tried to put himself out there like that, and that's why people expected him to be, or if it was just because he was so closely associated with Rolling Stone, people mistakenly assumed things about him and then found out he wasn't actually that way. I don't know which is which.
All right. So let's take our second break, and we'll talk about some of the biggest controversies in Rolling Stone history right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on. Hey friends, if you've ever been in the market for a new home, you know home shopping can be a lot. There's so much you don't know and so much you need to know. Like, what are the neighborhoods like? What are the schools like? Who is the agent who knows the listing or neighborhood the best? And why can't all this information just be in one place?
Yeah, well, now it is, everybody, on Homes.com. They've got everything you need to know about the listing itself, but even better. They've got comprehensive neighborhood guides and detailed reports about local schools, and their agent directory helps you see the agent's current listings and sales history. Homes.com collaboration tools make it easier than ever to share all this information with your family.
It's a whole cul-de-sac of home shopping information all at your fingertips. Homes.com, we've done your homework.
Hey, everybody, if you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible.
That's right. It's even in the name. Use code STUFF20 at checkout to receive $20 off your first month. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month every month, taxes and fees included.
Yep. Again, use promo code STUFF20 and you'll receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. Switch now at Visible.com.
For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Stuff. Look at all the stuff you should know. Okay, we're back, Chuck. And we're here to talk about now some of the low points of Rolling Stone history. This isn't a hit piece.
No, but I mean, I think all of the things that we're going to talk about in the last bit here can be classified under one, in one big bucket, which is bad journalism, lazy journalism, abandoning journalistic integrity for the sake of an article. And it's really a shame that they've done this kind of repeatedly.
Yeah, Joe Esterhaas is rolling over on top of Showgirl right now.
Oh boy, that's a sight. So I guess chief among these sort of high profile instances is the 2014 article, A Rape on Campus, by Sabrina Erdley, which made all kinds of news. It was a story about a gang rape at the University of Virginia at a fraternity house. And the more the story sort of was investigated, the more it came out that not only were there a lot of big time journalistic flaws, but, you know, eventually lawsuits and a full retraction of the story and police investigations that the story was made up.
I mean, journalism 101 flaws. Like the author, Sabrina Rubin Erdley, did not interview friends who came out publicly and said, hey, what this story is saying is not what Jackie, the pseudonym of the woman who claimed to have been, I think, gang raped even at a fraternity house. That's not what she told us that night. There wasn't even a party that night. And apparently it just became more and more clear that the entire event did not happen, and that the Rolling Stones journalists who they sent out to do this really important story didn't do some basic fact checking, and as a result just bought the whole thing hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, and in the end, Rolling Stone ended up either losing or settling a bunch of lawsuits with administration at UVA, some of the students and the fraternity at UVA. It came out during this process that apparently there were text messages that seemed to support the idea that this young woman made this up to gain the affection of a boy on campus. I tried to look as much into it as I could, but in the end, they completely retracted the article, which is a really big deal for a major publication to like fully retract and say, all right, this article, we do not stand by it. We're taking it, you know, we have takesies backsies privileges. And they even commissioned, I guess to their credit, a Columbia University School of Journalism review and published that, the findings of that review, which were not kind.
No, the review was titled Tisk, Tisk, Tisk.
Right.
But even worse than, you know, Rolling Stone losing face and credibility and millions of dollars is that, like, this was used as shorthand for people who kind of, who were like, we shouldn't really believe, you know, rape survivors.
Yeah.
And that has a chilling effect on actual rape survivors from coming forward and like naming their accusers. It was a huge, huge problem that was created by this that, you know, I think it would even came up in the Brett Kavanaugh hearing. Somebody basically used it for to that end too.
Camille Cosby talked about it on the courthouse steps.
Are you serious?
Oh yeah.
Wow. So yeah, so it was a big deal. It was a big fall down, and you can really easily point to that as the biggest mistake in the history of Rolling Stone magazine by far.
Yeah, another big one was an article in 2003 from Gregory Freeman about what's called bug chasers, which is what appears to be a very fringe thing where gay men want to be HIV positive and try to have unprotected sex with people they know are HIV positive. And basically the same kind of thing. Not a lot of fact checking. He interviewed a couple of doctors who he says they said that they said it was like 25% of the gay male community are bug chasers. And both of the doctors said, I never said that at all. Like, I said the opposite. And then the author later came out and said, no, I remember those conversations explicitly, and they're just not admitting to it. And I didn't record the interviews, which you should probably always do.
Right.
And so that was obviously another big sort of black eye on the magazine.
Yeah. And I think it was, they were saying 25% of new HIV cases come from bug chasers or something.
I think I misstated
that. But it's just a ridiculously, a ridiculous amount. So Chuck, this was in the past, right? There was another big one too, another big flub. They sent Sean Penn to interview El Chapo, like the most powerful, vicious drug cartel leader in the world. They sent Sean Penn to do it. And Sean Penn sent back a dispatch that was really flattering, really sympathetic, and really one-sided. And so they were really criticized for that as well. But that's all in the past. Rolling Stone has refound its footing, correct? And it's all good now.
No, apparently not correct. Just recently, I remember just reading this in my subscription not too long ago. Mm-hmm. They wrote an article about Taylor Hawkins after he, like, very soon after he died, mm-hmm. that a lot of the people in the article, famous musicians that were quoted, came out and said, wait a minute, this is really taken out of context. I didn't mean this stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't say this stuff. The article kind of basically said that the Foo Fighters kind of killed him with their schedule, and that Dave Grohl wouldn't let up, and it was, had a big reason. It was a big reason why he died. Mm-hmm. And that was a very recent stain.
They also did a hit piece on Marilyn Manson that didn't present any of his side of the story. He was accused of sexual abuse by an ex-girlfriend, Evan Rachel Wood. And it was, very one-sided. And a lot of people came out and said, like, the ones who were quoted were like, I gave them paragraphs and paragraphs of stuff, and they used one sentence, because I was speaking out in defense of Marilyn Manson. There's also one that was considered having given a moral victory to anti-vaxxers. They posted a story about how Oklahoma's emergency rooms were being overrun with people who were having toxic reactions to ivermectin, who were taking that cattle dewormer when they caught COVID. And apparently it was just fake, wrong. Not only that, they ran a picture of people lined up wearing masks in winter coats, and the events that they described took place in summer. So it was just from top to bottom a terrible story. And that seems to be what's going on. And I read an article on a website called Saving Country Music. And this author basically points to the hiring of Noah Schachtman from the Daily Beast to take over. And Noah Schachtman said, we're going to start making our journalism more immediate, more visceral, and faster, louder, and harder. And this Saving Country Music person is like, that's the opposite of what journalists are supposed to do. When you do things fast and immediate, you're sacrificing, like, follow-ups, getting secondary sources, fact-checking. And that seems to be where a lot of the most recent, like, flubs and biffs are coming from.
Yeah, like, I think it's that digital journalism thing where you want to be the first to break a story. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's just a minefield if you try and operate that way,
Yeah, but I also get the impression that it's also, it's clickbait. They're fanning the flames of outrage culture and at the expense of society's sanity, basically, is how the Saving Country Music person put it.
And they're trying to save country music.
Yeah, but no, they had some, it was a really erudite, amazing, like, really insightful post by Trigger on savingcountrymusic.com. You got anything else?
I got nothing else. I mean, this could have been a two-parter, but that's a good Rolling Stone magazine overview. I'm still going to read it, but I'm going to take it for what it's worth.
Okay, there you go.
But get a subscription to Cream.
Well, that's it, everybody, for Rolling Stone. And since Chuck said get a subscription to Cream, of course, that means it's time for listener mail.
This is a great email from a mum in New Zealand. Kia ora, Josh and Chuck. I'm writing you all the way from New Zealand, and it's currently 10:53 p.m., and I need to thank you. You, my friends, are my last bargaining chip, my last resort, and more often than not, the best thing to get a bit of peace. Sounds like an insult, but let me explain. I have two wonderful, beautiful, enthusiastic, intelligent girls, 11 and 9 years old, and a frequent occurrence in our house is the reluctance to go to bed. Sometimes sleep just eludes them. I get it. It eludes me too. However, if all else fails, what about Josh and Chuck? We'll usually get them to where I need them to be. Tucked up in usually my bed with your two comforting voices, teaching them about animal science and random things, they settle and relax enough to let old Sandman take them away. Although your content is incredibly interesting, your tones are soothing and comforting, like a big hug to settle into. And you are often my go-to when I need a comfort food podcast. And it seems you have the same effect on my girls. Keep being awesome. You're very much appreciated. From a tired mom, Bethany. And I wrote Bethany back and asked if she wanted to name her girls. And she said, absolutely. That is Allison Page. And she had just written me back after, I believe, using our show to get Paige to sleep.
Very nice. Allison Page, also known as Thing One and Thing Two.
That's right. And Allison Page, give mom a break. Cooperate at bedtime.
Yeah. Let's get it together, kids.
Get it together, kids.
Well, thank you. Who was the mom?
Bethany.
Thank you very much, Bethany. That was very nice to let us know that. And I'm glad we could help out. And hello to Alice and Paige and everybody there down under. Is she from New Zealand?
New Zealand.
Okay.
The downest of unders.
Exactly. If you want to get in touch with us like Bethany did, you can send us an email. Even from New Zealand. It'll get here. Wrap it up, spank it on the bottom, and send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.